I'm grateful for the scholarship and leadership of Kara Finnegan. Kara joined the Warner School of Education at the University of Rochester in 2003. She specializes in educational policy. Her teaching focuses on contemporary issues in educational policy, state and federal policy, sociology of education, research models. She received her PhD from the University of Wisconsin in educational policy studies, and she has conducted every kind of research imaginable on educational policies, programs, local, state, and federal. She's written extensively on the topics of low-performing schools and accountability policies, school choice, charter schools, inter-district choice, improvement, leadership. Her research brings in all sorts of elements, including education and sociology and political science. She is, in short, exactly the person we need to hear from as we deepen and broaden our discussion. And along with welcoming all of you, I'm grateful to introduce Professor Kara Finnegan. Kara, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm really honored to be here. I am an academic, though, so I need my laptop here, too. John made fun of me, actually, because my title was so long. I'm sorry. I just couldn't take any words out. So I'm here today. I'm actually not talking about Raleigh in as much as bringing some of the larger knowledge base across the country to these discussions. My name is Kara Finnegan. Thank you for the very nice introduction. I'm like all of you, I've just been deeply bothered by the inequities in our educational system. And unfortunately, it's not just here that I've seen these. I experienced them in New York City and Anchorage, Alaska. I've moved around a fair amount, and we see them in a lot of different places. So I became drawn to education policy to understand how we can bring about change at the system level, and that's what I'm going to talk about today. I'm honored to be able to be a part of a group that focuses on, all my slides may not work. Great Schools for All. See, this is the problem when you don't see it until it's there, so I might have to fill you in on some details. We're all gathered together in a short time period to keep some momentum going around, really trying to make sure everyone has access to the same kinds of opportunities. I want to start by talking about the context, though, in the U.S., in New York State, and in Rochester. I know a lot of you have heard these numbers before, but I think it's an important starting point to bring us together before I talk about the different policy solutions that have been used across the country. So, as you know, we're more racially diverse than ever, but we also are more segregated than ever. And this is across, in the U.S., we're seeing these patterns in a lot of places, not just here. We also know that most of the racial and socioeconomic segregation occurs between school districts. It used to be that we would see this in metropolitan areas in the inner city. There was segregation, but it's spread across the districts. More than a third of Latinos and African Americans now attend high poverty, 90 to 100% non-white schools. And segregation is most common in metropolitan areas that are fragmented. And I want to talk to you a minute about that. And so what we see is that instead of having the integration that we're all hoping for, we're finding that these communities are segregated and kids are really not having the opportunity to learn from each other. So what is fragmentation? I'm going to walk you through a few things today, and one of it is geopolitical fragmentation. What that is it's basically looking at any metro area and thinking about what the likelihood is that two children will go to different districts. So we find that fragmentation varies, but what it gives you is overlapping autonomous political units. So this might sound familiar. Across the country, we have a range. Some places are quite cohesive in terms of not having these separate units, whereas others, like Nassau-Suffolk County, is very high in terms of fragmentation. So some people think the fragmentation, these local units, are important because they can increase democratic participation, localism, efficiency, and local identity. But the problem is it works against these larger things that we're thinking about. There's competition, duplication of services, there's a hierarchy of wealth that results, and of course there's school district fragmentation. I have to get better at that. So here's a picture that'll help you to see what I'm talking about. So on the left is Milwaukee, and on the right is Jacksonville. Milwaukee is much like Rochester, with many of these smaller units, whereas Jacksonville has larger areas. And so this allows you to accomplish some of these things just like they did in Raleigh, because there's less fragmentation, less autonomy, that you're competing over the same resources. So, okay, that's across the country we see some of these patterns around segregation and fragmentation. And we know in New York, we also have a recent report talks about how we're the most segregated schools in the nation, in New York State. And one of the things this report talks about is how decades of reforms have ignored this issue, producing strategies that have not succeeded in making segregated schools equal. And I think that Gary Orfield has a really good point when he says that the problem is separate is unequal because of the imbalance of power and resources of many kinds across the racial lines and the deeply rooted attitudes that blame the victims of segregation for the inequalities that they face. So back on, in terms of the New York context, this report from UCLA was important because it highlighted inequality, inaction, and a damaged future. And what I want us to think about is how we're going to move beyond this inequality and move forward. So you can't see this probably in the back. The main thing is that the inequality in New York, the typical black students or Latino students attend schools where many of their classmates are low income. That doesn't happen for white students. It's much less extreme, and the intensely segregated schools have really grown over the years. Now, we see this changing, though, and many of you know this in the Rochester area, that many communities are actually, even though most of our districts continue to be mostly white, that there's a real shift, and a quarter of school districts in Rochester are drastically changing demographically. Okay, so we've already talked a little bit about this in the earlier remarks about how the city, we know the city center and the surrounding areas have quite a discrepancy. It's the 12th wealthiest county in the state, yet the second poorest city in the U.S. The racial isolation we know between the city and the suburbs, and in terms of some of the data around the city, it's not surprising then that we keep having some of these same things. It's the highest poverty rate among the big five. It's the lowest graduation rate among the big five. We have all of these numbers that are calling our attention to the problem. We have to decide when we're going to do something about it. Now, the Rochester Area Community Foundation did a wonderful job of calling attention to the larger issues in our community as well. The high rates of poverty, as we've already talked about. John mentioned the fifth poorest city in the U.S., and the concentration of poverty is some of the highest in the United States. So the problem is this isn't a new problem. This is 1970. And what you see are the areas that are darker are concentrated poverty. It's families below the poverty level. And you can see that even then, back in 1970, we had a pretty big discrepancy between the inner core of the city and the outside regions. Now this is now, and you can see it's just gotten worse. So again, if you look at the darker areas, are the percentage of people living in poverty, with the very darkest at around 75%. Now here's the flip side of the story. This is wealth. And again, you can see quite dramatically that the wealth is on the outside. The higher the wealth, this is median income of 100,000 on the outside, darker areas. And then the city is just left at the core. So now part of this was because of some state laws that ended annexation. As Rusk points out, state law guarantees that at the heart of every urban region will be a city growing weaker and weaker with every decade. Now, some of you heard me talk last year at the Presidential Symposium at the U of R. And I quoted Marion Wright Edelman and said, raise a ruckus, people. It is time to raise a ruckus. And I think that this is really evidence that people are raising a ruckus, that we're not going to allow it anymore. But today I'm going to shift gears a little bit and talk about what we need to do after we raise the ruckus. So now I'm going to talk about what kind of goals we need to have. And I see this as, I thought that this image was really nice to help us think about what we're doing. We have huge challenges ahead, kind of like climbing the Grand Tetons, which I went to this summer. They're beautiful. But we're really right now stuck below the clouds. We can't figure out how to get there. And the problem is we can't even see it. We're so far below what's happening. And what we need to do then is I'm going to talk about some different solutions that I think will get us above the clouds and be able to see the path to the summit. Okay. And Jennifer Leonard, I love this quote that you had. It is time for us to acknowledge Greater Rochester's poverty so that we can begin to address and reverse its insidious effects on our education, economy, and future as a region. Now, what prompts communities to address inequities in education? I've pulled together from the places that I know who have really tried to address these things, the things that have come up. And it's not just one thing. Often there are more than one thing that happen at once. One is shame. When you start to be in the news a lot, that makes you call attention to things. Another is crisis. So Detroit, for example, or many other places that are struggling, crisis can really bring about change. Another is a lawsuit. Brian, you'll know that many people respond when there's a lawsuit on the table. Unaccreditation. This happened in St. Louis. When districts are stripped of their accreditation, somebody has to figure out then what happens for the children in those districts. Dissolution. Memphis, which I'm going to talk about in a moment, they dissolved. So then people have to figure out what's going to happen. Economic concerns. Many times economic concerns are wrapped up in some of these other things, but that causes people to start to figure out solutions. And I have two more. Moral outrage, which we've talked about, when you have people who come together and just will not allow this to happen in their communities. And finally, stressed suburbs. And this is really beginning to be a pattern in many places where the suburban communities outside of the city, as they begin to change, are having some of the same problems, and that's causing greater attention to these larger issues. Okay, so what to do? A lot of times, I feel like, when communities, even though they've been pushed from these different directions, they go quickly and they try to find the quick solution before they figure out what the problem is. And I want to talk a little bit about that today because it's so critical to figure out what the problem is before we put forward the solution. Okay, so I'm going to talk about four different policy solutions that have been used across the country. The first one is change. It's the focus on change within urban education systems. This really holds that the problem is that low performance is the result of a lack of standards and accountability. This is a very common theme over the last few decades. Now, what you do then is you improve the incentives, sanctions, and governance structure of the city school district or others. Now that you hear things like standards, assessment, accountability, governance change like charters and portfolios, structural change, extended year and day, curricular changes like pacing and vertical alignment, human capital changes, retraining teachers. All of these things are important, and they begin to move us forward in different areas. But I really think that right now we need to think bigger. The reason why we need to think bigger is because of that summit I showed you a moment ago, and because the literature is really mixed on many of those things. It depends so much on implementation. It's really hard to scale up. And again, more importantly, we're tinkering around the edges of these bigger problems we've been talking about. We still have segregated communities. We still have larger community issues around health, employment, and housing, and the other areas that are challenging our communities today. So if we stick with those, I would argue that it's going to take us a long, slow time, and I don't think we have time to wait. We'll stay below the clouds for a long time. Okay, so another focus has been on place-based strategies. Here, low performance is viewed as a lack of investment that has caused decline or deterioration of a community. These are things that then the solution are to improve the health and social services and revitalize the neighborhood. You hear things then like full-service schools. We've tried our version of the Harlem Children's Zone. Obama's Promise neighborhoods all come within this area of place-based strategies. What this is then is trying to really increase neighborhood revitalization. It's a saturation of resources in a community and a strategic investment in families, the families that really have a lot of needs. This often involves neighborhood centers, adult education, and disconnected youth. And I think these are really critical when you have such challenged neighborhoods that we have. But there's a great book by Patrick Sharkey, it's called Stuck in Place. And he talks about how policies that target resources towards specific places, if implemented on their own, are unlikely to have broad impacts that will reduce racial inequality. So they're important, but they can't be the only thing we do. Okay, so here's a third area. This is now a focus on change across urban and suburban educational systems to promote integration. Low performance now is viewed as unequal opportunities across our educational system. Now you're thinking about trying to create access to opportunity through removing or reducing boundaries. Now, annexation was the way we did this in the past, but there are quite strict laws now that make it very difficult, and so you don't see it as commonly. It would be where a school district would pick up other school districts, or a city would pick up other towns. Consolidation, our Raleigh experts are going to talk about a little bit more today, and that's where you just merge them together, right? And that can have the more immediate impact than annexation can have because it happens right away. Then there's choice and mobility across systems. This is what I'm going to talk a little bit more about today because we have some of this in our community already. But before I talk about that, let me just talk for a moment about consolidation. This is what I mentioned before. Memphis, I grew up in Memphis, actually. I'm not a Rochesterian. But Memphis-Shelby County has had some of these same problems for a long time. And if you don't know, Memphis basically recently dissolved. It was at a point where they couldn't sustain what they were doing. Some of it had to do around the financial aspect of it, but the inequities were strong between the city and the outside county. So you might not be able to tell that well, but the blue is Memphis City, and then the kind of the box around it is the county. So it dissolved, so the county had to take it on, which resulted in a merger. Now this, some of these communities, it doesn't always go as planned, of course, because there's still political leverage people can use to remove themselves from consolidation. And so some of the communities then fought to secede, I guess, and create their own new districts outside of that. Now this, I only bring it up because it just shows that even in the, when things are moving forward, we have to find ways to continue to keep them moving in the right direction, because a lot of times our interest, as we were talking about before, local interests can sort of trump this kind of regional thought about change. Okay, but besides consolidation, which you're going to again hear more about, I wanted to talk more about choice across boundaries, because this has been one way to move forward, even though sort of slowly, because it doesn't require you to change the boundaries, it just allows movement across them. Now, there's all sorts of movement across boundaries, but not all of it has to do with integration. And so across the country, there's actually only a few that were designed to allow people to move across boundaries for integrative purposes, and Rochester's is the oldest. We've been around the longest, celebrating 60 years soon. Back in 1973, the commissioner, there were two commissioners who really kind of moved these efforts forward. I'm going to read this to you. I think you probably can't see it. Integrated education is one in which the child learns that he lives in a multiracial society in a multiracial world, a world which is largely non-white, non-democratic, and non-Christian, a world in which no race can choose to live apart. It is one that teaches him to judge individuals for what they are rather than for what group they belong to. From this viewpoint, he learns that differences among people are not as great as similarities, and that difference is a source of richness and value rather than a thing to be feared and denied. So there was a lot of momentum back in the early 60s and 70s to have some of these things. It ended pretty quickly, and we have not seen some of the same commissioner kinds of speeches around these issues, but it was at the heart of the program at the beginning, of the urban-suburban program. So this program that we have right now, I want to just talk about it as a mechanism that we have in our community. We have the green districts participate, and the city school district participates and allows kids to move back and forth. For many years early on, kids moved both into the city and outside, but for a long time now, it's only been going from Rochester City out. It's a small program. Like many of these, they serve often a small proportion of the community that exists in the city. The children apply to the program, and when they go to the suburban districts, there's 7 that participate, and they go to different schools out there, so they're pretty spread out in the various communities. Transportation's provided through a separate funding mechanism. A lot of people talk about transportation and mobility programs, and this one is provided in our state. You provide that separately. So I'm sure it's an issue, but it hasn't been one of the things they have to plan for. I think I might have mentioned it's only about 500 kids out of 31,000. But it is a mechanism that we have in our community that allows people to move across borders, and it's not been taken up to the degree that it has been in some of the other places because it's a voluntary program. As I was saying before, lawsuits sort of hold more weight, and where there's been a requirement to participate, of course, we've seen greater numbers. The reason why these kinds of programs, as John was talking about before, are important is that there is quite a bit of research. It's not a lot of research, but it's enough that's consistent, that talks about how integrated environments can result in improved post-secondary outcomes, improved high school graduation rates, increased comfort with people of other races, and there's been mixed results on achievement, and really it's partly been an issue of how we're able to analyze the different tests, and that there's sometimes a drop when people go to the different communities at first because of expectations and things, and that people sort of have a drop off and then have to build back up. And in some recent studies, social studies and science were actually seen to be where they had the biggest gains because not having the same opportunity in their city schools. Now, one of the things about the mobility programs is that they're not all working out exactly as planned. And partly this gets back to the investment we make in any kind of solution. So in all of the locales I've studied across the country, there's tensions around the purpose of these plans. What are we really trying to do? And what are we putting our efforts towards? Resistance to integration in both suburbs and the city. There's a limited city voice in many of the programs. There's limited expansion once they exist. There's lack of supports for students of color in many mostly white settings. And they're really politically tenuous given finances and competing policy demands. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about a fourth policy area. This is a focus on outside of the educational system to combat some of these inequities I was talking about earlier. Now, low performance is viewed as the result of decades of discriminatory policies that have created inequities between cities and towns in a metropolitan area. Now for some reason, people have a very strong, kind of like Raleigh, the stop you before you get to the North Carolina, have a very strong response to the word regional. So the solutions are regional strategies, but there's a variety of different regional strategies that people don't really consider. The first thing they think about is countywide schools, but there's many other things. There's interlocal agreements. These are cooperative agreements between government agencies. We have them in Monroe County. People have these things where they work across groups. They're voluntary councils. In many places, they're metropolitan planning organizations that in the past they've often focused on things like transportation. I guess that could be controversial, but not as controversial as poverty and educational inequity. So we sort of allow it to exist when it's not dealing with something quite so difficult and complex. There's also legislative councils, and Omaha has one of these. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about Omaha. So there's a person, John Powell, who is a wonderful scholar on race and poverty, and he talks about something called federated regionalism. What this is it's sort of a response to this idea that you can't work across these fragmented communities. He says that federated regionalism addresses racial and economic fairness in terms of accessing opportunities. It addresses the preservation of local character, and it addresses the responsiveness of government to local concerns. Because what you do is you keep those autonomous units intact. He suggests that actually regional and local kinds of layers, those two layers, can coexist in a federated structure, much like we have states and the federal government. He also says that one of the things to keep in mind, though, is that this federated regionalism needs to have the central driving force be racial and economic equity. So what Omaha did is this idea of federated regionalism. They took all of the communities in two counties, the districts, and they basically joined them together in what they called the learning community. And they allowed people to then move across this large, they started thinking about everything around education as this larger group. The learning community was now addressing the inequities across the whole system rather than thinking of Omaha's problems. Now, partly this came out of pressure because the Omaha Public School superintendent threatened the annexation of the districts. So he started pushing the envelope on the other communities that, you know, hey, we're going to take on the rest of you, or you're going to help us figure this out somehow. And that got people to the table. And there was also a lawsuit threatened. There were a few different things that, as I mentioned, these pressures can come to a head. And so in the end, what the groups decided was they'd rather be in on making the changes and deciding the terms than wait till somebody else decided for them. What Omaha had was a vision that all children within the learning community, now they're thinking this broader way, achieve academic success without regard to social or economic circumstance. And their mission was that together with the school districts and community organizations, they would demonstrate, share, and implement more effective practices to measurably improve educational outcomes for children and families in poverty. Now, this was, it started in 2007, but there were years of conflict before this. They have a 21-member governing board across the region, and that's an elected board, and then they have the superintendents have an advisory role. They have the authority to set a common levy on the property across the 11 school districts involved, and then they redistribute those resources as needed. And they have several major programs at once. I think that's a key to some of these larger efforts, is that it can't just be one thing. It, as I said before, it can't just be place-based strategies, but even beyond that, they have open enrollment, which allows kids to move across all the boundaries. They have magnet schools that have a sort of a regional pull in different places, and they were very strategically about where they placed those. They have elementary learning centers where they could really invest a lot of efforts in the early grades, especially in certain communities. And then they had an advocacy arm for families in poverty. And those all were working together to be their efforts towards reducing some of these inequities. Now, the Twin Cities and Minneapolis also have had a longstanding metropolitan council. And it's interesting because when you look at what they've done over the years, they really for a long time focused on, I think, economic interests. Not that these aren't all related, but that was the driving force. And then the last few years, they've really shifted their emphasis towards racial and economic equity. So they have this new thing called Thrive MSP 2040, where they set out their strategic goals for the next several years. And here's what they say. Equity connects residents to opportunity and creates viable options for people of all races, ethnicities, and incomes so that all communities share the opportunities and challenges of growth and change. Now, like us, they're focusing on concentrated poverty, and they had an equity assessment where they basically did a data analysis of racially concentrated poverty and developed indicators of opportunity. So hand in hand, looking at both the challenges in the community and where the opportunities were to build on the strengths that already existed. The council chair says, we need a new paradigm to improve access to economic opportunities so that persistent racial disparities become part of our past and do not determine our future vitality. So I've also been really intrigued recently. I'm bringing these three main examples to you because I think they're some of the most comprehensive efforts we have out there today. Omaha, the Twin Cities, and Richmond. Now, I know some of you were speaking with some people from Richmond this summer, And what's interesting about Richmond is they've really started to tackle some of these same things that we've been dealing with. They have an anti-poverty commission that pulled together a number of people in the community. And, you know, we have a lot of commissions, and what we want to do is make sure they're moving towards action. And this group examined data and spatial maps, similar to the Minneapolis-St. Paul group, to really highlight the most challenging area in these opportunity zones. They developed an agenda for action. Now, they decided that all of their efforts were really going to start out around employment. But they focused on how workforce development, economic development, housing, transportation, and education regionally all affected workforce development, all affected employment opportunities for those who are in the most challenging parts of the city. And they prioritized policy areas. So there's going to be a number of things you want to tackle, but they didn't try to tackle them all at once. They had a real clear set of goals in terms of what they were going to do when and timeline for those things. And they were advised by a community group that involved half the people were living in or working directly with communities of need. And I think that's so critical because the voice of people in those communities are not always at our tables. I also noticed that they have an Office of Community Wealth Building. They were reluctant to focus too much on the idea of breaking down poverty to think a little bit more about empowering low-income people. As the person who's leading that program said, we have a lot of talent and social energy and potential contributions to society. They're just wasted when people are deprived and not given the opportunity to fully develop the talents they do have. Okay. So I'm just going to recap on the policy options that I've been talking about today to address these inequities that we have in our community and our educational system. So the first one was improving incentives, sanctions, and governance structures. This is so common right now, and it's been going on for decades, and we haven't seen a lot of change. The second was to improve the health and social services and revitalize the neighborhood. And as I mentioned, these are the place-based strategies that have you reinvest in a particular community. The third was to strengthen the mobility programs to allow movement across boundaries. And the fourth were regional strategies for housing, education, economic development, transportation, and other areas focused on racial and economic equity. Now, I hope you've been convinced by now that the first one is not going to be what we need to do in our community to really tackle these larger goals. Sorry, I got ahead of myself. Two and three are really, really critical in our community. And you can think about these as some of the shorter term strategies we need. We need some of those place-based strategies so that our neighborhoods don't continue to deteriorate. And we need some of those mobility programs so kids aren't stuck in the place that they live. And they can have access to things in the short term while we work out these bigger things. But many of the communities like ours who are really trying to tackle these things, they're really trying to think big, they're focusing on these regional strategies. Because it's as we were talking about before, it's not just a city problem, it's a community problem. And when you have a community problem, we're a region, and we have to think about how we work among these different areas or how the things that we're doing now work against the goals that we have to bring about great schools for all. So what's interesting is when I was looking back into some of the things that have facilitated these type of regional coalitions, I was quite struck by the fact that many of these people are in the room today. So regional coalitions often start from these kinds of groups. Churches, the business community, universities, grassroots citizen groups, foundations, and mayors. When these groups can all work together, imagine the power they have. Okay. So what does all this mean for a regional plan to bring about great schools for all? Well, many places have developed a Metropolitan Planning Council. These kinds of councils allow you to oversee a long-term plan for reducing poverty in Rochester by sort of moving away from all those individual units and the interests that they have, kind of moving a step above that. In many places where they've started to work, we see a comprehensive analysis of barriers and high leverage strategies, a combined focus on all of the different areas I've mentioned, housing, economic development, education, employment, and transportation, with racial and economic equity at the core. They also, where they're starting to work well, have a variety of stakeholders included, including those who haven't been at the table in the past. And I think that's a good challenge for Rochester, because many people have done a lot of this work in the room, and I think the work we want to build upon, we also want to kind of open up to new voices. And they also use data and research to identify root problems and drive regional policy decisions. Now, the problem is we don't just want the Metropolitan Council, as I said before. There needs to be a parallel mobility and place-based strategy to build upon the existing infrastructure and programs that we have. But they have to be coordinated, and they have to be expanded if we're going to reach more students, and not have this kind of a situation where you're sort of, as Sharkey puts it, you're stuck in your place. And I think one of the most important things, actually, that I'd like to put on the table for another area that needs to be included in a regional plan is that we have to rebuild the trust and the leadership in the communities that have the most challenges. We have to make sure that their voices are part of the policy change, and that we're developing new leadership capacity in all of these neighborhoods and areas so that we don't just have people from the outside working in, but we have people on both levels working together. Now, as a policy person, I can't help but think that the state should be more involved in all of this. I hesitate to say this because I don't want to say that we can't move forward without them, and I think we need to. But I think it's important to put pressure on state policymakers to provide fiscal and legislative support. In most places that's happened, in most places where you see these broader things happening, the state policymakers are also involved. So what could the state do? The state could actually fiscally and legislatively support a Metropolitan Planning Council, as I suggested before. They could also support a comprehensive regional school mobility strategy involving open enrollment and magnet schools. They also could fiscally and legislatively support neighborhood stabilization in the most challenging neighborhoods in our community. And they could require each town, village, and city in the region participate in a regional housing collaborative and contribute to the development of opportunity areas to reduce the concentration of poverty. In having this kind of legislative and fiscal support like you see in some other states, it could help not only prompt it, but sustain it as we start to work on all of these things together. Okay, so now back to my analogy or metaphor around the mountain we're trying to climb. I think that if you think about it, all of these things, having a greater understanding of the different components we could put together in both the short term and in the long term, will give us greater clarity and allow us to see where we're headed. But along the way, we're going to have to rely on each other because this is hard work, and we need to develop a clear plan to the top. But I think Gorefield put it really well in the speech he recently gave about Brown versus Board of Education, and says, a new civil rights agenda for American education. It is in the end about us, about who we want to be, about how we go through the great transitions in our society, about how whites join with others to imagine and create a new society enriched by the contributions of all. It is an immense challenge, but also the great opportunity of our time. Many Americans, many educators care deeply, like all of you in the room, and have knowledge and skills that could move policy forward. A movement begins when people decide that injustice is unacceptable and challenge the conscience of their community. It asks people to replace fears with dreams, to reach across lines, and to commit their talents to a fairer society. Thank you.